I had a look at your schedules and I saw that no one's covered it. And of course, it's an important topic and you should see it. I'm sure you've heard this. People call it Susie, and I'll lapse into that as well. All right, so today is just going to be generalities about supersymmetry. I'll give you an overview of the course and give you some information about useful books, and then talk in general about what we know about particle physics in terms of the theory and field theories and stuff, and then hopefully give you some motivations for supersymmetry. But okay, so let's first list some books. So a good book for explanations is Balin and Love. Supersymmetric gauge field theory and string theory. Okay, that's published by the Institute of Physics. Okay. And then there's a very nice phenomenological, more sort of physics, phenomenology-based book. Oh, mad. Just drop me coffee. And that's Ian Aitchison from Oxford, it's his book. Supersymmetry in Particle Physics. Okay, and that's Cambridge University Press. You must forgive me, actually. I didn't introduce myself. So I'm Ben Allenack. I'm from Cambridge. Okay. All right, and then as always, there's the Oracle Wikipedia. Right, and actually, there's a nice article online by Steve Martin, which I think you've seen already, and this is the Supersymmetry Primer, and it's on the archive HetPH 9709356. So this is very nice. The only thing you've got to work out that you've got to be careful about is that Steve Martin uses the opposite sign metric to the one I'll use, mostly plus metric. So, that can be a bit of a pain when switching between one and the other when you're doing fermions. And of course, supersymmetry's got a lot of fermions in it. Roughly half of it is fermions. Okay. And all right, so there is also the Vess and Bagger. So this one is one of the few supersymmetry texts that's published with, as far as anyone can work out, no trivial minus sign errors in. It's supposed to be pretty much invulnerable. So, but it's quite terse. There isn't much text in there. But if you're worried about how the algebra works out or something, you can find it in Vess and Bagger. And I think that one is just called Supersymmetry. Okay. Good. And then there are some other books, but those are probably enough to be going on with. So required knowledge. Well, of course, for most of these particle physics courses, you'll need quantum field theory, but I understand you've got that. some knowledge of the use of symmetries in quantum field theory will be useful, and actually the spontaneous breaking of symmetry, so the Higgs mechanism in particular in gauge theories. So symmetries, spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, good. So that's what you need, really. This course is actually based on a course in Cambridge that Fernando Quevedo gave for about 5 years. And he's teched up some notes, which are still being developed at the moment. And they've got quite a few minus sign errors in. But the explanations and stuff are very nice in there. And I will closely follow those notes, apart from skipping some bits because we haven't got enough time. So it may well be that you get a copy of those notes so you can follow what I'm going to say more closely. All right, so I've got a 10. I'm not that accurate on the blackboard, to say the least. So if you think you spot some minus sign errors and stuff, call me out, and I'll be only too glad to try and fix them, because, when you're seeing it for the first time, you can't tell whether it's your lack of understanding or just the fact that I'm a bit dopey at 10 o'clock in the morning that's, giving you a minus sign. And supersymmetry, it's a nightmare for minus signs, okay? I spent months trying to get them all right, and I've probably not completely succeeded. Well, hopefully I have. All right, good. So let's tell you what I'm going to tell you. So first, today, like I said, we'll just give a bit of physical motivation, talk some generalities. Then we'll get into SUSY algebra after we've discussed spinners in more depth. Because after all, supersymmetry is actually quite easy, really. The hard bit of it is understanding spinners properly. Okay, so we'll do SUSY algebra, and then we'll talk about representations of supersymmetry. So just as quarks come in a representation of SU3, and that means there are, they come in a three-dimensional representation, so there are three colours of quark, red, green, and blue. And we also get representations of supersymmetry algebra with different spin. And so we need to understand those and work out how to construct them. We'll talk about extended supersymmetry. You can have more than one. I may discuss, if I think we're going quite quickly, I may discuss something which is useful these days in brain theory, which is BPS states, which crop up in extended SUSY, but that's droppable if we're not going that quickly. And then I'll talk about superspace and superfields. So if we go back to the QCD analogy, superspace is the analogy of colour space. Okay, so you could draw axes with red, green, and blue. They'd actually be complex axes in general, red, green, and blue. And you could have some quark, which has one green unit. And QCD tells you that if, on a point-by-point basis, you rotate those axes around in a complex way, where you, on this unit sphere, nothing changes. The energy doesn't change and the interactions don't change. And so this colour space is the analogy of superspace, okay, which has something to do with spin. And instead of the coloured value of the field, red, green, and blue, we have superfields, which make the symmetry manifest. So we'll talk more about that. Then we'll discuss Lagrangians. So I'll be working in four dimensions. Lagrangians. And we're mainly going to be concerned with global SUSE here. I might sketch just a few details of what happened in local supersymmetry. There's a few things that you ought to be aware of, but we've got no time to really go into it. And I'm not an expert on that anyway. Then, if we have supersymmetry, if it's got anything to do with nature, we'll see that it has to be broken. Just experiment disagrees with supersymmetry. So this sounds a bit paradoxical. We impose a mathematical symmetry on the theory, and it's no good, and then we have to break it. So, you know, what's the point of doing that? But actually, even the broken supersymmetry theory still imposes some constraints and gives us some nice properties of the theory. And so we have to work out how we're going to break supersymmetry in order to agree with experiments. And we'll talk about that. So we'll talk about, there's two basic ways of breaking it directly, and that they're called F and D term breaking. We'll talk about what that means. And actually, if supersymmetry is local, you get an analog of what happens with the Higgs mechanism. And so we get this super Higgs effect, it's called. Where, well, the gravitino acquires a mass, basically. And then, at the end of the course, we'll discuss the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So what I'm going to do, basically, is lay it out for you, the representations, some of the interactions in it. And so this thing is basically the standard model in a direct product with n equals 1 global SUSE. It may well be an effective field theory, which is the low energy limit of some local supersymmetry. Okay, but one thing that we'll have to just revise is the representations of the standard model there. So I'll spend a bit of time on that as well. Oh, and I should mention, if you want to, you can ask questions during the lectures. Okay, so let's discuss some physical motivation for why we should be sitting here rather than outside eating donuts and drinking coffee. What do we know so far? What do we know about theoretical particle physics? Theory of particles so far. Well, we know that the basic theory is quantum field theory. And a field, quantum field, corresponds to a particle, what we understand as a particle. So it's actually an excitation in a quantum field. We think of these quantum fields, in some analogy, as some weird sort of quantum jelly. So we have an electron jelly, quantum electron jelly, throughout all of space. And where we measure an electron, there's a local disturbance in its probability amplitude of this field. It's like the jelly's wobbly there. And, of course, we have lots of different kinds of jelly, lots of different kinds of particles. And, for example, when you make them move, if you have a localized disturbance in the electron jelly and you push it or accelerate it, it tends to make the photon jelly wobble. And so, accelerated electrons will emit photons. But we can split these into two kinds of fields. We have, as you know, we have fermions and bosons. And, of course, they differ by their spins. So we have integer number of h-bar spin for bosons and half integer for fermions. And the bosons, as we know in the standard model, are the force carriers of the theory, and the Higgs boson. So all of the gauge bosons are spin 1 in h-bar units. So the photon, the Ws and Zs and the gluons. Whereas all the matter particles, quarks and leptons, are fermions. Okay, so of course, I'm sure you know, actually, that supersymmetry unites the different spins. Gives you a symmetry between fermions and bosons. I should point out that in these lectures, and well, actually, it's a natural number, including zero. Okay, so the other thing we know, sort of with a broad brushstroke, about particle physics is that symmetries are really important. And these can be classed into two types. We have internal symmetries, and these act on some other indices that we have on the field. So if we have a color index A, say this is a, I don't know, I've written down a scalar field, but it could be, supposing we had colored scalar fields like we do quarks. This A could go from 1 to 3, 1, 2, 3. 1 means red, 2 means green, 3 means blue, whatever you want to call it. So under an internal symmetry, we get some transformation of these indices. Well, actually, you know, this could be a matrix. There's an implied summation over repeated indices throughout these lectures. And we get some matrix where now, you know, if this is a red field, we can be transformed into some mixture of red, green, and blue fields with some extra rules. So if this m is a constant, then we have through in x mu, then it's a global symmetry. And if m depends on x mu, if m is a function of x mu, then it's local symmetry. And of course, local symmetries play a very special role in the standard model. I mean, of course, what you're saying is not only can you switch in a continuous way from red to green simultaneously all through the universe, we can do switch from red to green over here and do from red to blue over here. And the theory's got to be invariant. And that has very important consequences. In order to make the theory invariant under those kind of symmetry changes, we have to add a vector field which has color and has very specific properties under the symmetry group. It has to actually transform under the adjoint representation. In SU3, that's an eight-dimensional representation. It has a color and an anti-color. They're not the same. They can't be the same, so you can't have red bar. But basically, through imposing this symmetry, you know, out pop gluons. Okay, and then there's a whole other set of symmetries which are not internal. They're external symmetries or space-time ones. Space, time, symmetries. So, for example, changes to the space and time coordinates and themselves. So, for example, Lorentz symmetry, where we boost things, or Poincaré symmetry, where it's invariant if we move stuff. So if you do an experiment in Abu Dhabi, it's the same as doing it in Geneva. You should get the same results. None of the probabilities should change. Rotations, translations, coordinate transformation. So coordinate transformations in general, like in general relativity, all those kind of things. And so we know these symmetries are important. Because they're used to label particles. So it's actually the eigenvalues of some of these symmetry operators, these generators of the symmetry, give us our particle labels. So mass, spin, color, charge. They're all eigenvalues of either external or internal symmetry generators. And also they determine what interactions are allowed, and sometimes they constrain the strengths of the interactions between particles. And, you know, as you know, it's not just the symmetries that are important, but actually they're the way they're broken is very important. Like in the Standard Model, we have the Higgs mechanism. And that, of course, gives mass, it's thought, to some of these bosons and fermions. And that's that's an important part of the Standard Model. Yes?
So how are the symmetries used to label particles by mass and spin and color and all that?
Well, yeah, so, okay. So, the mass. These quantities are eigenvalues of the symmetry operators. So we'll see this more later on. But so in the Poincaré symmetry, there is a generator of the Poincaré symmetry, which is P mu. And if we act on some state with P mu, acting on some state, then we get M squared times the state. So actually, you know, we can label this quantum state with M, and that's the eigenvalue of this P, or square root of the eigenvalue of this P mu. And it's the same for the other things. I mean, the electric charge is just the eigenvalue of the electric charge operator on this state, and so on. So that's all. Oops. So the basic model, very well tested by experiment, as you know, is the Standard Model. works well compared to experiments so far. This is a triumph of particle physics. The standard model has been tested in literally hundreds of completely different ways. Some of its predictions are very accurate. Some of them are accurate to 10 significant figures, and they agree with experiments. Some of them are a lot less accurate. You can only make 10% level predictions or measure them at the 10% level, but they still work so far. There's one or two possible tentative chinks in the armor, but the basic message is it's really well verified by experiment. Okay, so the standard model, as you know, has implicit within it the space-time symmetries, which are four-dimensional Poincaré invariants. And there's a classical symmetry of the theory, which is four-dimensional general coordinate transformations. So in other words, this breaks down when you consider quantum corrections. So it's not a quantum symmetry of the theory. But if you just consider the model at tree level, it's pretty easy to make it invariant under messing about with space and time in fairly random ways. And of course, this gives you classical gravity theory. But that all breaks, as I'm sure you've heard in string theory lectures, once you consider loop corrections. Okay, so those are the space-time symmetries. And then, of course, you know about the internal symmetries, which is a gauged SU3 cross SU2 left cross U1 Y symmetry. So, of course, the U1 is just it's like a copy of quantum electrodynamics. And we just generalize the symmetry properties of that to SU2. So it's like a more complicated version of electrodynamics. We complicate it even more to SU3. So as you know, SU3 describes the strong interactions. In other words, why the proton is held together. And these two collectively parameterize the electro-weak interactions, which are responsible for radioactive decay, for instance. And in fact, as you know, the spontaneously symmetry broken via the Higgs mechanism down to electromagnetism, which is also a gauge symmetry. So in the end, in the low energy limit, we have SU3 color cross QED, basically. So as I've already mentioned, gauge fields have spin H bar. So for example, the photon, which we just write as A mu, all the gluons, G mu. So these have an index A, which is a color index, which goes from 1 to 8. Matter fields, fermions, and so on, of spin, h bar over 2. And these come in three families of copies. Copies except that they're successively heavier. And then the Higgs. It's the odd one out. It's all on its own in the standard model. Has spin 0. And, of course, this does the important work of spontaneous symmetry breaking. It's also the odd one out because no one's found it. Yeah.
So what is a G in the
flame, right? Sorry, this is the gluon. Yeah. That's the gluon. This is the photon. Thank you. So the Higgs is the odd one out. The LHC is hunting it. And if the Higgs standard model-like Higgs mechanism is true, the LHC will find it eventually. It's got to. We already know from indirect data here.
Sorry,
that's all right.
But from that left side, it seems that you're including general relativity as part of the standard model, right?
Well, yeah. That's right. So that's where this the spin 2 particle is the graviton. So, okay, I mean, most people, when they say the standard model, they don't include these general coordinate invariant. But it's pretty easy just to put a root det, you know, root minus g in front of your action, and you get this gravity out. But, you know, you're right. Most people wouldn't consider that to be part of the standard model. Okay. So that's a good point. So if the graviton is really there, that's also not been seen and isn't likely to be for a long time. Spin is 2 h bar. Graviton interacts far too weakly to be seen anytime soon, unless there's something drastic wrong with the theory. For example, unless there's a large extra dimension or something. Okay, so the LHC is hunting the Higgs. It'll find it if the standard model is right. We know from indirect data from the past that it can, where its mass can lie. And actually, its mass is less than something like 180 GeV from the electroweak fits at LEP 2. So this LEP and LEP 2 at CERN. And, you know, the LHC will have, well, the parton center of mass energy, so the quarks and gluons that are hitting each other, will have a couple of TeV center of mass energy. So they've got easily, you know, through E equals mc squared, easily enough energy to produce Higgses like this. And actually, they can produce Higgses up to a TeV or so, which is as heavy as they could be in the theory anyway. Good. So problems with the standard model. Let's start a new board. Well, there are quite a few. They're kind of theoretical and aesthetic, primarily. I'm just going to focus on a few that people worry about. Okay, you guys know about this. You want quantum theory of gravity not just a classical one. Everything else works in a quantum way. So it would be bizarre and actually probably inconsistent for gravity to not be a quantum theory, and that just doesn't work in the usual field theory way of writing it down. So you have to do something else like string theory or something else. There's a hierarchy problem in the standard model, and the hierarchy problem, there are actually several problems hidden in there. But the basic question is, why is MZ much less than the Planck mass? Okay, so MZ is roughly, roughly it's 91.1887 GV. Okay, so it's of order 100 GV. And the Planck mass is of order 10 to the 19 GV. So in a fundamental theory, we'd expect all mass scales aesthetically to be the same. And actually, when you look into details of the theory, you see that quantum corrections tend to be suppressed by a loop factor. That's just 1 over 16 pi squared. Okay, that's 1 over 100. But then times the mass scale, the heaviest mass scale in your theory. So why aren't we getting corrections to this mass of order the Planck mass divided by 100? So in 10 to the 17 GV. So MZ over M Planck is 10 to the minus 17, much less than 1. Why is that? So actually, classically, you can come up with ways, new symmetries and the way that it's broken in order to explain this number. It's not too difficult to solve. What's really difficult to solve is, once you fix that for the tree level theory, why don't the quantum corrections wreck it? And this question is called the technical hierarchy problem. And to my mind, the only thing that satisfactorily solves this and that's consistent with current data is low energy supersymmetry of things that have been thought of so far. Okay, so there may well be something that no one's thought of. There are ways you can complicate the theory, but you still need supersymmetry, really, I think, in the high energy limit. So this is a prime. This is going to be a prime motivator for supersymmetry, this question. And we'll talk more about that towards the end of the course. Then there's of order 20 free parameters, dimensionless parameters, in the standard model, which is just set by hand. Okay, this isn't maybe a huge problem, but aesthetically it would be nice just to have one and to explain where all the other ones come from in terms of that one. It's not just that there are 23 parameters. Actually, there are hierarchies in here. There's in the fermion-Yukawa couplings, there are factors of a million, and actually if you include the neutrinos, there are factors of like 10 to the 10 between the different couplings. They haven't got this instability to quantum corrections, but nevertheless, you'd like to understand why there are hierarchies there, why they take the values that they do, apparently. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Now I've alluded to it. Okay, this problem, this quantum corrections problem, is a problem with the Higgs mechanism. And it actually occurs because scalars are special. Okay? So, have you done renormalization yet in field theory? You have, okay. Good. So if we look at corrections to the Higgs mass squared, so that's given by quantum corrections to the Higgs two-point function. So we have some tree-level value, okay, plus, some loops, right? So there's a loop with a Higgs in it, for instance, and there's a loop with fermions, and some higher order guys and some other guys too. Gauge bosons, blah, blah, blah. All right, so if you look at, so K is a loop momentum. If you look at this diagram, it goes roughly d4k over 2 pi to the 4, and then you have some coupling constant lambda outside, and then of course there's a propagator, 1 over k squared minus, so minus Higgs mass squared, say. Okay. So a particular feature of scalars is this integral is quadratically divergent. In other words, if I integrate k up to some finite but large momentum scale lambda, big lambda, then we've got, you know, four powers of momentum over two. So this thing goes, you do the naive power counting, and this thing goes like, okay, some loop factor times a coupling times lambda squared, okay? Same for this one. That also goes, yeah.
For vectors, this wouldn't happen.
For vectors, you you get the same problem. So actually, and with fermions as well. Okay. With vectors on the outside, on the external lines, you mean, or
no,
internal? In the loop, yeah, you get the same problem. In fact, even with the fermion. You know, you've got each fermion goes like 1 over k slash in the high energy limit, so again, you've got this form. Okay, so these diagrams all go quadratically. So this is only a problem with scalars, the scalar masses. With the other guys, you don't get this, this lambda squared, you get log lambdas. Okay. And the problem is, you know, presumably, there is some heavy physics associated with the Planck scale. And so the largest quantum correction you're going to get is if you integrate up to the Planck scale and you substitute m Planck in as this cutoff. Okay, so now we have total m Higgs squared, which is supposed to be, you know, something of order 100 GV squared, has a correction which looks like m Planck squared over a loop factor. And you can't make this heavy. If you make this, you know, this is directly related to the Z boson mass, which is also, that's why it's got to be of order 100 JeV squared. You can't make it 10 to the 17 JeV. So one thing which you might try and do is organize a cancellation here and say, okay, maybe there's a relative minus, maybe this thing is equal to all of these things to the first 15 significant figures, but there's a relative minus sign, and miraculously they cancel, but that just sounds fishy, right? It's an aesthetic problem, okay? Nevertheless, people don't believe it. And so that's the problem with this, with scalars and with the Higgs. This Higgs mass with a few order one factors gives you the Z mass, gives you your electroweak scale. Yeah.
I don't really know anything about the renormalization. You said, so the first correction is lambda squared, and that's the dominating correction? That's the dominant correction?
So what I'm doing is looking at this integral as lambda tends to infinity. Usually you integrate up to infinite momentum, right?
Right.
And then you do the renormalization prescription. So what I'm doing here is saying, okay, normally you take this the limit as this integral goes to infinity. But I'm just going to consider lambda to be some large high-energy cutoff where the standard model is no longer a good theory. Presumably at higher momentum modes, you should use some other integral, perhaps over string theory or something. So above the Planck scale, for instance, the theory may be finite. Yeah, mass squared. Yeah.
That term there is just like the like something that shows up, like it's the amplitude for a diagram, right?
Yeah.
So it, presumably it's connected in some way to the correction for the mass. And I guess
Okay. So I mean, I've kind of skipped all this, but yeah, there's a self-energy. You know, the propagator of the Higgs is given by all the self-energy corrections, and you know you get 1/p² minus the effective mass squared.
So the problem is that the correction for mass is on the order of the Planck scale, if you assume that lambda is the Planck scale.
Yes.
So it seems like the only problem here is that the correction of the mass is on the order of the Planck scale, if you assume that the correction of the mass is on the order of the Planck scale.
So. Okay. The problem here is really history. Because, I don't know about you, but when I was being taught renormalization, I thought I'd never heard anything so crazy in all my life. Well, taking away infinity in order to get a finite answer is crazy, right? But, so the modern interpretation of renormalization is that actually you can't believe field theory up to infinite energy scales. Presumably something like string theory is the correct description, and you should really be doing this integral in string theory. We know in the low energy limit, though, string theory looks like field theory. So some infinite integral in the string theory looks like integrating up to some momentum scale with field theory, and then you could imagine adding on the rest of it, the finite bit with the proper string theory correction. You'd have to do some matching, and this thing is actually, everything is now finite, okay? But there is a physical scale here. This isn't just a mathematical artifact. That's really like the string scale. It might be the scale of some heavy states associated with gravity. And so, you know, that bleeds into your theory. So even if it's not really a problem with infinities in the theory, it's really a finite correction from some heavy particle, actually, that appears in the loop that's associated with the quantum gravitational scale. It's going to give you corrections of this order. This is just a quick way of working out roughly what the correction would look like. Yeah.
But since we've never gone to the electroweak scale, why can't we assume that the cutoff is there?
We have gone to the electroweak scale.
Really?
Well, the Tevatron's doing collisions at a few hundred GeV, and the electroweak scale is, well, okay. The vacuum expectation value is 2.46 Jev of the standard model Higgs in some conventions. So we've got above. So the thing is, we know that there's a Planck scale. Okay, that's you can measure Newton's constant, and you know when you turn it into mass units, it's 10^19 GeV. So the logic is, even though we don't understand quantum gravity and stuff, there's got to be some physical energy scale associated with that. There's got to be some physical states, and you know this could be. It could just be to our, the fact that we don't understand field theory at very high energies. That's a possibility. But if field theory behaves like we think it does, you can integrate up to some finite energy scale and get the answer. I mean, this has worked before. This kind of shorthand way of doing things has worked. For example, with, let me see, four Fermi interactions, okay? So in the early days when they were doing low-energy scatterings, they scattered electrons and muons and stuff. And what they saw, before they knew about gauge theory, what they saw is that quite often you send in an E plus E minus, and you get mu plus mu minus out, okay? And they were doing this at low energy, so they weren't sensitive to the details of what was going on in here. But you measure this coupling. It's called G Fermi. It looks like 1/mass² times some other unit. You work out what this mass scale is, and you get 100 GeV. Okay. This theory actually is nominally normalizable. So this is the effective field theory that you get when you integrate out the W and Z bosons. Okay, this isn't quite loops. And of course, actually I'm digressing now. Maybe I should stop there, because that's really tree level, not loops. And it just describes effective field theory. Okay, well, the thing to take away from this is, okay, you can play this game with the electroweak theory and look at, I don't know, corrections to the photon propagator or interactions with photons in it. And there, the physical scale we know, you can play this game and indeed you get some log lambda corrections, and you see that when you put lambda equals MW into those corrections, then that is the correction that you get, because the W's a physical scale associated with the high energy effect, the place where the effective field theory of QED runs out. Basically, you have to generalize the model to include the W and Z bosons at that scale, and therefore you get these MW, log MW corrections in that case. So it's just the same thing here. We just expect there to be some physical scale associated with this Planck scale, basically, and some heavy states that are going to run around in loops and give you finite corrections of order n Planck over a loop scale, a loop factor. Okay, I'm really running ahead. This is like, I'm going to go through this, well, probably in less detail now. I'm going to go through this again in the last lecture. But it's worth it, because it is. Okay, if you want to read ahead, you can read Manuel Dries's Introduction to Supersymmetry on the archive. Okay, and he has a bit where he goes into these loops in more detail, and you can see this hierarchy problem in more detail there. Okay, there is a problem with dark matter in the standard model. Standard model has no dark matter that works. So we've got to add something else. It has some neutrinos in it. They're a candidate for dark matter, but the wrong kind. They smooth out density perturbations in the universe on small scales too much. So you need to add some other candidate of dark matter, there are various other problems which you can see. So you can modify the standard model to address these problems. So some people build grand unified theories by expanding the internal symmetries. You have some grand unified theory. Okay, this could be, SU5 is the simplest, actually. So this is one gauge group which contains the standard model within it. And then you Higgs it at some high energy scale and break it to the standard model. And then, of course, later at scales of around 100 GeV, you break this down to U1 electromagnetism. So this reduces the number of free parameters. you can see that immediately, because remember, with each gauge group, you have a different gauge coupling. And so in the standard model, we have three. We have one for the color, one for SU2, and one for hypercharge. Whereas this thing just has one gauge coupling. Okay, so these three are going to come from one. And actually, the UCOL couplings and stuff are also related to some degree. So there's an example of an internal symmetry. Or you can expand the external symmetries for example, supersymmetry. This is going to relate bosons to fermions, as I advertised. What it's going to do here is it's going to relate this coupling to these. So it's going to give this to be lambda F squared. So with every boson loop, we have a spin a half partner whose coupling is related. When you have fermionic loops, you get a minus sign. Supersymmetry is going to tell us that the mass of these fermion states is equal to the mass of its partner. And so all of these quantum corrections cancel each other out. The fermions will cancel the bosons, and there'll be no quadratic divergence left because it will be multiplied by zero. Okay. All right, that's it for today. Next time, we're going to build up I'll introduce with the Poincaré algebra and spinners, and then we'll build up to the supersymmetry algebra and representations.